I'd like to start this morning by reading the opening verses of the Dhammapada, which are some of the most well-known verses of the Buddhas. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows, as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows, like a never-departing shadow. Part of what this points to is that all of our experience, everything we experience through the mind. Even what we experience through our physical sense doors is experienced through a process of the mind processing it or constructing it. So what is the mind actually? There's a teaching in Buddhism that helps us to understand a little bit about the mind. And it's a teaching called the five aggregates. That sounds like a technical term, and it's a translation of a term that's not at all technical from the Pali. It's translating the term skanda from the Pali, which means heap or bundle. It was a kind of a common term used in the time of the Buddha. You would carry a skanda of sticks. So it's not a technical term at all in the Pali, but it was translated into this term aggregate, and it makes it sound more complicated than it is. But basically this teaching breaks down our experience into five categories, five groups, so we can think of it that way. And these five groups are the body, and that's the physical body, and then the other four are aspects of the mind. They are consciousness, feeling, perception, and mental formations. So the consciousness, feeling, and perception, I like to think of those three as functioning together. They're essentially what's given to us in our experience, what we know, what we're conscious of. And then there is feeling, which is not emotion in the way we think of it, but just whether something is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And then there's perception, which is the recognition of objects. And I like to think of those three, consciousness, feeling, and perception, as what is given in our experience. It's what comes in through our sense doors, what is actually experienced. And then from that, we create all kinds of things. We have reactions, we have emotions, we have beliefs and ideas that are created from that what is given. Those are the mental formations. So those are the four aspects of mind: consciousness, feeling, perception, and mental formations. Today I'd like to mostly speak about one of those aspects which, when it's not understood, it can get us into trouble. And that's the aspect of perception. So I'd like to mostly focus on perception today. So the function of perception is recognition. We see something and we perceive it's gray and square. And we also perceive that it's a book. So this is just the function of perception, to simply have us able to recognize what we've seen before. So it's a simple process that happens in the mind. But it can get us into trouble when we don't understand it simply as a process that's happening. There's a story in the suttas that I'd like to share with you. And you're probably, many of you are very familiar with this story, actually, but may not know that it's an ancient Indian story. This story, the Buddha is using as a teaching story in this sutta. And my understanding is that this story was around in the time of the Buddha. It's not a particularly Buddhist story, but the Buddha used it as a teaching story. So it's a story about an elephant. The elephant and the blind people. And the context of the reason why the Buddha used this story is that some of his monks were in town one day going for alms round, and they came upon some wanderers and some ascetics from other groups, not Buddhist ascetics, but other sects. And they were all discussing the Dharma, but they were saying, the Dharma is like this, the Dharma is not like that. And they were quarreling among each other about what the Dharma was. And so the Buddhist monks went back to the Buddha and explained this to him and said what they had seen. And the Buddha responded with this teaching story. Formerly, bhikkhus, there was a certain king, and that king addressed a man thus. Come now, my good man, bring together all those people who have been blind from birth. Yes, your majesty, the man replied, and gathered together all the people who had been blind from birth. Now, my man, said the king, show the blind people an elephant. And so he presented the elephant to the blind people, saying, this is the elephant. To some of the blind people, he presented the head of the elephant, saying, this is the elephant. To some, he presented the ear, saying, this is the elephant. To some, he presented the tusk, the tail, the trunk, the body, the foot, the hindquarters, the tuft of the tail, saying, this is the elephant. Then, the blind people having been shown the elephant, the king asked them, tell me, what is an elephant like? Those blind people who had been shown the head of the elephant replied, an elephant, your majesty, is just like a water jar. Those that had been shown the ear of the elephant said, an elephant, your majesty, is just like a winnowing basket. Those that had been shown the tusk replied, an elephant is like a plowshare. Those that had been shown the trunk replied, it's like a plow pole. Those that had been shown the body replied, it's like a storeroom. The foot, like a post. The hindquarters, like a mortar. The tail, like a pestle. The tuft at the end of the tail, like a broom. Saying, an elephant is like this, an elephant is not like that. The people came to blows. And the Buddha responded like this. Some recluses and Brahmins, so-called, are deeply attached to their own views. People who see only one side of things engage in quarrels and disputes. So this process of perception, the story points to the process of perception. People had an experience of the elephant. They perceived something about the elephant. And then they not only had their perception, but they created a belief or a view about that perception. The elephant is like this. Now, there may be good reason for thinking the elephant is like this, because we have experienced it. They had experienced it with their own perception. And that's one of the reasons why we so strongly attach to the views that are created out of our perceptions. So we take something in through our experience, we perceive something, and then we create a belief, a view about it. And this can get us into trouble, because often we are only seeing a certain aspect of the world. Another teaching of the Buddha's that I really reflect on a lot, a very short sentence he said, in whatever way they conceive, it is ever other than that. In whatever way they conceive, it is ever other than that. So think about, consider how this relates to the story of the elephant. For the blind person who was shown the tuft of the tail, saying the elephant is like a broom, it's not incorrect to say that this part of the elephant is like the broom, or I perceived the elephant like a broom. But there's more to the story that person did not experience. So when we take things in with perception and create an idea about it, we often end up blocking out other possibilities because we haven't necessarily seen the whole picture. And that's my understanding of what the Buddha means when he says, in whatever way they conceive, it is ever other than that. There is always something not quite known in our experience through our conception. So this can lead us into trouble because we end up having, as in the story of the elephant, people coming to blows over their beliefs around the elephant. We engage in quarrels around the beliefs. So the Buddha had another story, another teaching about how this process happens in our mind. He describes the process kind of in a step-by-step fashion, from the body through to the creation of beliefs. And he says, so taking it from one sense door, from the eye, there is the contact of the object with the eye, and from that is consciousness. So that's the beginning of the process. There's consciousness of seeing. And then what one sees, one feels. It's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And what one feels, one perceives. One perceives color, form, an object, a book. What one perceives, he says, one thinks about. And what one thinks about, one mentally proliferates on. And that's the point at which all of those views and opinions and beliefs are created. So it starts from this very simple process, perception. We think about what we perceive, and then we mentally proliferate. So we can think about an example of, for instance, maybe a coworker getting angry with something we did or said. And in the process of that, if we're experiencing this coworker getting angry with us, we have all the perception, the experience coming into our senses, the sight of the person, the sound of their voice, the knowing, the hearing of what they've said. And we can imagine that there might be different responses to this experience. We can easily imagine responding in kind by getting angry back. But there's also the possibility that we can imagine that we could respond in compassion. But so often what happens is that we don't see actually the distinction between the thing that we're perceiving and the reaction we have to it. It happens so fast in our mind that we go from the perception to the thinking to the all the views and ideas that are born around the perception. And so often the perception and the reaction are confused. The beliefs and views that motivate our actions are often confused with the perception itself because those beliefs and views function in a very transparent way in our experience. We don't even recognize often some of the beliefs that we hold. But at an even subtler level, the process of perception itself is often misunderstood. There's a sort of a turning on its head, or a perversion almost of understanding about perception, that leads us to the view that there's something to hold on to and someone to hold on to it. If we think about how our minds work, it's relatively easy to see that there are some aspects of our experience that we completely construct with our minds. If you get lost in a fantasy, it's easy to recognize that that is a construction of the mind. I had a really clear example of this at one point. I had had a long relationship with a man, and at some point we broke up, and there was a long period of a lot of emotional difficulty around that breakup. But after a period of time, I had worked through it all, and there was no reactivity in my mind anymore when thoughts of him would come up. And that was a great blessing. It was wonderful when I finally got to that place. But I still noticed that when thoughts of him came up, the mind created a world in which I was still in relationship with him. And when that bubble popped and I came out of that world, it was confusing almost. It was confusing partly because there was no longer any reactivity around the thoughts. I mean, in the past, when those kind of thoughts had happened, when I came out of that world, what I felt was anger and grief and hatred and despair and all kinds of things like that. But when I came out of it, once those emotions had gone away, it was just simply, that was a world that the mind had created, and it wasn't real. But there had been a strong belief in the reality of it. So the mind had created something and then believed its own creation. And in coming out of it, it was very clear that it had been simply a creation, that that was not true. So we do this kind of thing a lot. So it's relatively easy to see that kind of construction of mind, that we are living in worlds created in our minds. But it's a little bit harder to see sometimes that everything we experience, including our physical perceptions, it's also what we experience of it is made by mind. I don't know how many of you were here when Utejaniya came, but he did a lovely demonstration, and I'll try it with you. Here, he said, I'm going to show you your mind. Put your hands together. How do you know that your hands are touching? It's because you're aware of it. The mind is what is making you know your hands are touching. It's an experience created in the mind. I saw a demonstration that also helped make this really well understood. It's a great demonstration. It's at the Exploratorium. I don't know if it's still there or not. I think it was about 8-9 years ago that I saw this. And I walked into the Exploratorium. I was with my nephew, bringing my 10-year-old nephew with me to have fun at the Exploratorium. And when we walked in, I saw in the distance, hanging from the ceiling, there were maybe 10 bars about, you know, that big around, you know, just like almost like steel bars hanging from the ceiling. They were maybe 5 feet long. And there were maybe 10 or so of them spaced about 4 feet apart. And there were flashing lights on the bars. And I looked at that and I thought, I wonder what that is. and didn't think much about it and wandered around the exploratorium with my nephew. And at one point we took a break and sat down to have a drink. And we were sitting there drinking and he looked up and he said, "It's a school bus." And I said, "What?" And he was looking up at the bars. And I could see there were yellow flashing lights and then a little bit of red. And I thought, well, it's the right color for a school bus, but I don't see a school bus. And then he said, "It's butterflies." I said, "What are you talking about?" And so I stood in front of it and I looked at it. And I recognized it's kind of one of those perceptual games that you have to look at it just right. And when the eyes moved at just the right rate across this set of bars, it became a full screen, about 40 feet long, 5 feet deep, upon which you were seeing images pass by. A school bus. I could even read on the side of the school bus the name of the school district. It was phenomenal. It was amazing. And my understanding of how it works, I didn't actually read the description. I couldn't find the description of the exhibit. But I think there's a thing called persistence of vision, where they were flashing the lights on a bar, and they were flashing the pattern as if the school bus was driving past. So it was like seeing through a slit the school bus driving past. And then it would pick up on the next bar where it would get to in a particular time. And the eye carried the image across from one bar to the next to make it appear like a screen. It was the clearest demonstration of the way the mind constructs experience that I've ever seen. It was just quite amazing. So it's a way that our mind is put together to do this. It's not a mistake that it does this. It actually helps us. But when we don't understand that it's the way our mind is working, it can get us into trouble. So essentially, delusion comes in and works with perception to make us really believe that something that is impermanent is permanent, that something out there is permanent, and that it's not simply something that is coming and going in our experience. So perception and consciousness are like a reflection in our minds. I'm not saying there's nothing out there. I'm not saying that there's nothing that we contact. There's actually, I believe at least, there's something out there that we contact. There are others that may or may not believe that, but I'm not saying that there's nothing out there. But what I am saying is that all we can know of it is what our mind experiences. All that we can know of it is created in our mind. It is like a reflection. It's like a mirror. Our experience reflects the world out there, but it is not the world out there. On one retreat, I had a really interesting experience of how perception can impact our experience, our emotional experience. I was meditating in Burma, and the monastery I was in was relatively close to a village. So there's a lot of village noise that came into my awareness during the meditation. And at one point, I heard a squealing, and this squealing would just happen over and over again. Sometimes it was just a squealing, but then at some point, the mind recognized or realized or decided that this was the squealing of a pig, and that the squealing of a pig was a result from the fact that the pig was being slaughtered for dinner. And this was upsetting. This was disturbing. And so I was working with some of the emotions around this perception. And some days, I don't know how long later, when I heard that squealing, I mean, I figured they were having pig daily. Because it happened every day. At some point, I recognized or perceived it. Instead, the squealing happened, and instead I perceived it as a bat. It was the squealing of a bat flying. And there wasn't particularly a emotional response to that. It was just, oh, that's a bat. And it was quite interesting to recognize how the perception of pig versus bat had impacted my emotional experience. So the relationship of this to our suffering, the way in which we suffer in our lives, when we start to look at how suffering works in our minds, we start to see that suffering is created by wanting things to be different than they are usually, by wanting to hold on to something, by wanting to get rid of something. We want to have a better experience, a more pleasant experience. We don't want to have this experience. Any other experience would be fine. In my opinion, it was really the genius of the Buddha to point out to us that it's not the experience itself that causes, not the thing that we want to change that causes our suffering. It's the wanting the thing to change. It's the wanting to hold on to it that causes the suffering. When the wanting ceases, the suffering ceases. And you can see this in your own experience. If you play with it sometime when you want something, you can pick something, you know, relatively innocuous that you want, like maybe a chocolate craving sometime. You know, just see if you can just notice the wanting and not act on it. And see what happens to the feeling of dissatisfaction when the wanting goes away. When the wanting ceases, the suffering ceases. So we can see that the mind creates the wanting, that aspect of suffering is a process of the mind. But it's harder to see, and it's also true, that what we want, the thing that we want, is also created by our minds. When we really look at it, what we want is a perception. It's a reflection in the mind. Again, what we perceive is not really the thing. It's a reflection. And that's all that we can really want. That's all that we know of it, is the reflection that's in our minds. I had a demonstration of this on another retreat where I really wanted a particular meditative experience. And I suffered a lot over wanting this particular meditative experience. And I began to just look at that suffering. I looked at that wanting. And at some point I began to recognize images in my mind of describing to the teacher that I had this particular meditative experience. And I realized that what I wanted was to be able to tell somebody I had it and to have them look at me in a particular way because I had it. I had no idea really what I wanted. I mean, the thing itself. But I sure wanted to be able to tell somebody that I'd had it. And it was so clear to me. When I saw that, I just laughed, just like you're laughing. I mean, it's kind of hysterical, you know? It's like, it's just something in my mind. It was just a construction in the mind. So not only is our suffering created by the wanting, but what we want is also created by our minds. There's actually nothing more than a thought, a view, an idea that we want. A fleeting image in our mind is what we want. There's actually nothing to hold on to. So when the mind starts to witness its role in this creation of the suffering, when it sees this process happening, it sees it creating images and then clinging to them, it starts to understand and it starts to let go of the processes that put the suffering together. We can't stop perception. It's something that just happens. It's a process in our minds. Hearing the bell is something that just happens. You know, you can't really do it or not do it. I tell you, don't hear the bell. You know, we can't do that. So in our normal state of consciousness, perception is a process that simply happens. And when we can see this process, we can start to gain some wisdom that allows us to let go of the suffering that we create around it. So those are my thoughts on perception. And we have some time if there's any comments or any questions. There's someone in the back.
When you get what you want, it creates a sense of satisfaction.
Yes.
And that's what you are after.
Yes.
Is satisfaction a creation of the mind too?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yes, it's true. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why that process keeps going. Because when we get what we want, we get that moment of satisfaction and it feels good, you know, and we think that because that happens enough to us, we start to think that that's the way to end our dissatisfaction, by getting what we want, because that moment of satisfaction happens. What we don't often take the time to do is to actually witness that same feeling of satisfaction, or even actually a more sublime version of it, can happen when the wanting stops. When the wanting stops, it can feel like you've been let go from a vice grip. And that is also a construction of the mind. Everything we experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. And the satisfaction, I mean, if we go back to that Dhammapada verse, speak or act with the corrupted mind and suffering follows, like the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. So if we are always acting on our wanting and trying to get what we want, that just perpetuates this desire. It perpetuates the wanting, more wanting, more wanting. And we suffer when we can't get what we want. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never departing shadow. If instead we act without that kind of grasping, just allowing things to be as they are, happiness follows in a very natural way, because the ending of the wanting is the peace. It is the happiness. And Betsy?
You told a story that captured our amusement about the pig, hearing the pig noise. And then you went one step further, but backed off later on to decide it was a bat. I think the human mind is well equipped to hear sounds and interpret, because if it had been a tiger, it would have been important for your survival to identify tiger. Sometimes I find myself in an awkward position relative to any arising event, between the wanting to survive and then taking it that extra step. I wonder if you could elaborate a bit on what is natural, what is going to arise in any case. Because sometimes I can sense my own judgment about, oh, whoops, you know, you dummy. wasn't the pig being eaten for dinner. And yet, it's important that my mind take at least the first step.
Yeah. I mean, you know, this. What I want to say here again is not that it's not appropriate to act on our perceptions. I mean, it does. It is a huge survival mechanism, as you point out. I mean, if we're being run after by a tiger, or you know, somebody is coming up to us, you know, with a threatening look on them, you know, it's important to be able to respond. You know, it's not so helpful to just, you know, this practice is often misinterpreted as being just accept the way things are and don't do anything about them. And that is not the case. The point of this practice is that we can make wise choices about our experience and not simply be at the mercy of our reactivity. Now, sometimes I think the biological force has a kind of reactivity to certain things. Seeing a tiger coming at you, you're probably going to do something about that. Maybe turn and run, which might not be the best thing to do, but you know, you're going to do something. Maybe you'll freeze. That may be what happens. The kind of body fight or flight response comes in, and that's. There's nothing wrong with that. Mostly what we're trying to do in this practice is to observe what's happening. Observe how we get caught and how we can let go of being caught. So if you're caught, the process or the practice is to observe that caughtness, like I did with the feelings around the emotions about the squealing pig. I was caught in that, and that's just, okay, this is what's happening right now. Observe this emotional response. And in a retreat, there's a lot of emphasis on observing and not doing. And in the sitting meditation, there's a lot of emphasis on the observing and not doing. But in our lives, we can take the opportunity to watch, well, how do I respond to something? And to not to look and observe when has it been a skillful thing and when has it been an unskillful thing, and to not necessarily make judgments about what your response is, but to learn from it. Just to learn from it. I don't know if that's helpful. This is probably the last question.
Yeah. In a practical sense, or a balanced, decent, right-sized type of being as mature as possible within any given situation, I find myself sometimes, you know, there's that psychological thing of sometimes where you're passive-aggressive, or you're overreactive, and the responding is being proactive, but within the proactive, there is still reactive, and that in conflict, sometimes conflict met straight on is the only way to deal with it. It's not avoiding it, and it's not saying something's bad with it. Perhaps you may get a little angry, frustrated, or whatever, but without facing it resolutely, that it is upsetting, that it is improper, or even abusive,
mm-hmm.
that it's okay to get angry, and it's okay to be in that stance, because it's just a moment of passing. It's that judgment that it's not okay to get angry. It makes it like a result, kind of like a... And then letting go of the anger, of course, once the situation is dealt with.
Yes.
But that judgment of that you're not supposed to get angry or you're not supposed to get frustrated with certain things is kind of a clinging to being like in this constant state of peace. It's not real.
Well, you know, you're right that basically most of us, and I think, you know, the vast majority of beings, will respond and have reactivity. And you're right that it's simply what we need to do is to be able to be with that and not be reactive to that. If we get angry, to just be with that and learn from it and perhaps know what do I need to respond to and how is a skillful way to respond to it. I do believe that it is possible to, I mean, I've seen in my own experience as my practice has deepened that I don't get reactive to things in the way that I used to anymore. So that, you know, that kind of stops happening so much. And I believe that it is possible to experience something that might make one angry and be responding with compassion as opposed to anger. You know, that there is still a response. There's still a response to say, this should not happen. This needs to change. This needs to stop. But it doesn't come out of anger. It comes out of compassion. So I think that's possible. But you're right that most of us are not there. And what we do need to learn is a very skillful way to respond to the things that do come up, to the anger, and to try to be skillful around how we respond to that. And to judge it is not so helpful. And to say, I was bad to have that is not so helpful, because you're right, that ideal of just being always peaceful and blissful, it can create an unreal expectation for how we should behave, and that's not so productive. So yes, thank you. So we need to stop, and thank you all for your attention.